Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, hello, and welcome. Or should I say welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast, rising above the noise as ever. And it's, I guess, the end of the season, guys. And because it's the end of the season, I've got a full house with me to my left, chief sports writer of The Independent. It's Jonathan Liu.
Whoa, how's it going?
Yes, very good. Thank you. Thank you for asking. To my right, it's Miguel Delaney, chief football writer of The Independent.
Right, morning, actually.
Yep. I mean, that, you shouldn't struggle so much with the basic greeting. And we've also got Jack McBrook, who is here to tell us about how many times he watched The Royal Wedding this weekend.
Once live and then the extended highlights again on Sunday.
Yeah. Genuinely sick of me. You shouldn't be out of the pod today.
And with you know, the big festivities of the weekend, Miguel and Johnny didn't enjoy the royal wedding. Jack watched it twice. I watched it once.
I didn't not enjoy it. I just didn't. I didn't watch it. Yeah. It might have been very enjoyable, but I've never really been like Diana's funeral. You know, Diana's funeral, boring.
Less. I mean, I could understand why you'd go to a wedding. More than going to
I was 11 years old. It's not great kids entertainment. I walked out after but about not, 10 minutes to play Championship Manager.
Do you not remember? The thing with that was that was like channel when she when Diana died, very huge segue early doors. Channels 1, 2 and 3 suddenly became pure like news television, and Channel 4 was just full of kids shows, and it was like Channel 4 had ropey kids shows because it didn't have the rights to all the good ones. It had like Okie Doke, like the Tweenies. You know, not really like the high grade Teletubby stuff. We're not talking Blue Peter.
Not even Nickelodeon level.
No. Well,
Cartoon Network in the early days.
Yeah.
Didn't have Sky as a kid. Always wanted Cartoon Network. Mm. I had to watch that at IKEA when Mum was shopping. Anyway, huge segue, early doors. But
from one event where inexplicably devoted fans lined up to watch a match between two parties, both familiar with a divorce, participate in. A meaningless relic from the past, some might say.
Very original joke format.
Thanks, Henry. Thanks, Henry.
Saw no tweets along those lines on Saturday whatsoever.
So the FA Cup final, in which, if you haven't heard, I've got some news for you. Manchester United lost to Chelsea. The score was 1-0.
Interesting that you went to Manchester United lost rather than Chelsea won. Bias.
Yes.
Agenda.
I think Chelsea don't feel like they've won. Willian is my favourite person in all of this. In case you were under any illusions as to how some of the squad feel about Antonio Conte, their now departing, in brackets, question mark manager. Willian posted a picture of them all celebrating with the manager starred out, I guess. I don't know how else you'd say. Yeah. By, so blocked out by trophies. Yeah.
Yeah, so he would have, once he had the photo on his story, he would have then swiped up to bring up all the emojis, and then he selected the trophy emoji. And he has like
step by step.
He's resized it three times, so it's big enough if you put them one on top of the other to block out all of Antonio Conte on the photograph of the whole Chelsea squad celebrating. And he's dotted a few other trophies around, so it looks like it might be on by accident. But of course, it isn't by accident.
But not, you can't pass it off as an accident.
How would you say Willian's Instagram game compares to yours?
Well, he's got more followers than me,
but
fewer gym selfies.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I would. I think it's a great idea, actually. I think next time I've got a photo with us, I'm going to block out at our boss with emojis.
Could he not be saying our manager is pure trophies?
Yeah, he could be.
He's pure. He's a serial winner.
Yeah, as God they profess.
What emoji would you use, though? The banter emoji?
Which one is the banter emoji? The man behind the laptop.
Okay, William actually left the stadium very early as well. He was. There was just footage of him. Like, I think this is before 6:30, something like that. There was footage of him in a get into a car outside.
Before 6:30, the game's still going on.
Oh, not 6:30. Sorry, before I was thinking of a 3:00 kickoff.
Yeah, like we didn't even see him come to the mix zone.
Yeah,
he was there. You guys were there. Overall thoughts of the game?
Just awful. I think terrible. The worst game I've been to this season. It picked up a little bit in the second half.
And why was it so bad?
It's just so. dreary. I mean, it was kind of the worst of both teams. Actually, I wouldn't say the worst of Chelsea, because what did strike me is, even though Conte played very defensively and counter-attacking, you could see this wasn't like the poorest Chelsea of the last few months. Like, in every single challenge, you could see how committed the player, like, there's real conviction. And again, like, there's a debate, I suppose, whether that's down to the circumstances. From what I'd heard throughout the Chelsea camp over the week, there was a real lot of personal pride here. They wanted to make up for the season. I think that came across. But as a slight tangent from that, after the game and his Mondays, Conte wanted to make a few points. And there's been, I suppose, there's been this whole debate about how Chelsea play. And apparently some of the players want to play more attacking football. And Conte intimated in his Monday briefing to the journalists, and he thought about this a fair bit, so he wanted to say it, that they say play attacking football, but with this squad you have to play defensive football or something along those lines. And I think that's... I suppose the intimation is that one of the reasons maybe that he's almost certainly about to leave is, among everything, among all the difficulty of transfers, is that maybe a certain style is demanded of him. But he obviously feels that if he wants to play a certain style, then give him the players for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like kind of Hazard and 10 others, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, the fact that they've gone to playing an Arsenal cast-off as their main centre-forward in the cup final instead of the guy they spent £70 million on beating United to last summer says a lot about, you know, about the type of players they've been able to sign.
Yeah. I thought it was an okay game. I mean, I wasn't there. I was kind of watching it slightly tipsy. Might have something to do with it, through like a sea of heads. But I thought, in terms of like terrible cup finals, it really wasn't a patch on 2007, I think, which was the first one at Wembley.
That was United Chelsea 1-0 as well.
Yeah. I was in Boston that day. Didn't watch it.
It was an absolute, like, the worst cup final I've seen in my life.
Was that bad? It's kind of the problem that you get with the FA Cup nowadays is that because it matters so much less than the Premier League, like, because generally speaking, the teams in it are teams who would be competing for the Premier League. Like, there's kind of... It didn't really feel like there's anything at stake yesterday.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a big day out for the fans, but for the players themselves and for the kind of the broader narratives about the team, it doesn't really matter who won or
lost. Although, weirdly now that they've lost it, it feels a lot worse for United because of...
Right,
because to a degree, it was almost a kind of referendum on United's season that way.
It would have been kind of like a fig leaf, but now they don't even have the fig leaf.
Yeah, exactly. But also, what it said about... I mean, I think in... Generally, kind of United, it's a weird season. United, they're second, they've ostensibly made progress, but it doesn't feel like they haven't. And there's been so many flat performances, bar five big games in a row where they won them all and they came back in a few of them, one against Chelsea, one in the FA Cup against Spurs. And then there was, of course, the City game as well. And, like, I suppose one of the feelings was that Mourinho had instilled this resolve in the team, but it still needed them to go behind to bring out the best in them. But you can't keep relying on that. And this was kind of, you know, it kind of evened out in a way. They went behind, and this time, like, well...
And even in the second half when they were dominating, they didn't really look like... They were just chucking the ball into the box. They never really looked like doing anything. The first half, they were all over the place. They missed Lukaku, hitting lots of long balls, no shape. I thought they were really, really poor.
Yeah.
Very predictable. Their lines are incredibly, like, unsubtle. Like, Sanchez will get the ball and he'll do that thing where he cuts inside. Is he going to dink one to the far post? Yes, he is.
Yeah. I think you're talking about Chelsea being defensive. One of Conte is, for me, I think he's one of the best coaches in Europe in terms of what he can do. I don't think he is an attacking or a defensive coach, where, you know, there are lots of coaches where you define them as one or the other.
Well,
I think he's very good at adapting his game to the situation.
I agree with that. But I think he sees himself as actually an attacking manager. His ideal, if he had the players, would be to play
the 4-2-4.
High pressing, play the game on your terms. But he feels that with what he's got at Chelsea, he has to adapt, and we'll say he can, which he won a title.
We've seen him do it. We've seen him win in different ways, which I think is the sign of a very good coach. And on this occasion, it was defensive, and it was kind of, if we can stop them scoring. But I guess they know Mourinho. They know what Mourinho's football's like. If we can just...
Hazard himself said it when we interviewed him on the Tuesday in the mixer in the Chelsea training ground. And, you know, we know what Mourinho will do.
Yeah. United didn't have, and we talked about this literally all season on the podcast, United don't have any sort of ingrained attacking coaching that tells people what to do. It's basically work it out when you're in advanced positions. That's obviously not the case when you watch teams like Manchester City, but this is how Mourinho wants to do it. And there were a lot of times, especially towards the second half when they're 1-0 down, where they're in the opposition half and they've got the ball and everyone's just stood still. and the ball's getting passed around. And I just felt like this has been the whole problem all season, and it's not going to change unless Jose Mourinho, who's an incredibly stubborn man, suddenly decides, oh, actually, I do need to coach some attacking football. I do need to hire maybe an assistant coach who specialises in this or something along those lines.
One of the primary issues of Mourinho, and to be honest, this isn't exclusive to Mourinho. I think it's the case with almost every manager, bar Alex Ferguson. But maybe Mourinho's personality makes it more pronounced. He's had such success and is so kind of proud of that success then that he can't deviate. He still fundamentally wants my way is the right way. So there's this kind of stubbornness to it almost.
Yeah, it's what we saw with Wenger. Yeah. It's the path that all managerial careers follow, with the exception of Sir Alex Ferguson. Once an idea is successful, why would you then deviate from it? Of course you're going to kind of keep hammering the
same
idea.
He's 55. 55-year-olds don't generally change their entire worldview.
But that's it. They get outdated. Diego Simeone is the Mourinho 2.0. It's a brilliant defensive coach, but he's got more to it. At the end of the day, and Father Time is undefeated. These phases will come and go. And if you don't adapt, and that is the great success of Ferguson, was that he could adapt and he could bring in new assistants that gave him new ideas, and he changed things around. I guess we should talk about Conte and his future. What do we think? It seems almost certain that he will depart.
We better get a move on, because
It's almost.
By the time you listen to this podcast, he could well be gone.
It's a bit of a standoff, though.
We discussed this last week, didn't we?
Yeah. He doesn't have a better job to go into. They don't have a better replacement. There's the financial issue. No one wants to blink first. If Chelsea sack him, they have to pay him more. He doesn't want to walk away from money. So,
and if he wants face-to-face meetings with the boss, then he's not going to be able to do it in London.
Not for the moment.
Because Roman's currently outside the country.
But what did you think of that story, actually?
It was on the front page of a lot of the papers, including the Times, this morning. Basically, the Home Office, in my experience, is incredibly slow, inept, and opaque. So I don't know if this is a political thing or if this is just the Home Office being the Home Office. I mean, we've got to remember they literally just deported a load of British-born citizens for no apparent reason other than the fact they were black. So it's not necessarily for me tied in with the politics, but we know they are going to take a closer look at some of the Russian links, right?
Do we really think, though, that the Home Office is capable of enacting geopolitical policy when it can't really...
Bumbling idiots, yeah. No, I was somewhat surprised to see it given so much.
I thought a lot of the headlines, this might be unfair in them, that the word "yet" was missing, if you know what I mean. So, like, a lot
he's
of
not
the,
yet has his visa renewed.
He's been barred from the UK, hasn't
he? Yeah, exactly.
What I would say is that if somebody high up in the UK government said, right, to sort Abramovich his visa, it would be done fairly quickly.
What would be a big story and be interesting is if they didn't let him back in, full stop. I mean, that would be a huge moment for.
Made him get in the really long queue. Don't let me use the e-passport gates and make him get in the really long queue, and then make him go through the red gate.
Although the e-passport gate is often it's slower for me.
No, mate. Until you've gone in like the non-EU queue.
Okay.
I regularly have to go in the non-EU queue.
Because
it's just a disaster. It's like it is so slow.
Electronic passport. It's
the electronic passport
bit.
Thing is much much better.
Oh, it's not great.
It's
not great.
Much, the amount much of times
it's a bit potluck.
The amount of times it fails.
Miguel, do you have a kind of like? I imagine you have a sort of tatty, worn out, overused passport which you don't really take good care of, and maybe the kind of like.
Well, he does have a photo of himself in it.
The laminated, like plasticky bit, you need to scan through, has maybe gone a bit worn out.
He doesn't take care of his passport, obviously.
A glorious Irish passport with a harp on it.
Have you got a Spanish one as well?
Yeah.
Oh, that's just brags, isn't it? Do you use both?
Yeah, no, I use the Irish one. Because I suppose you get kind of addicted to having all the stamps and...
I recently got some people all the good stamps are gone, so. Sorry.
Am I actually... Is it legal to have both? It is, of course, yeah.
Yeah, probably. and if it isn't, you just said it on a podcast. So
there's a Home Office van coming around your street right now saying, go home.
just check the skin's the right shade. I think... With Conte possibly leaving, at some point we'll have to talk about his replacement, but I guess by the time that really gets going, we'll all be in full Champions League mode.
What about Leonardo?
Who would you like to see and who would you expect to see?
I'd like to see Sarri because I think the football would be really good and he'd be interesting. I don't want to lose Enrique. I don't think he's that good a manager.
he's a complete arse to deal with.
Yeah, I don't really want to go to his press conference and be berated for. Jardim, good football, but dull. Although, interesting, if Jardim happens, was he used at Chester or someone else? It could be then Wenger to Monaco.
Yeah, Monaco tried to get Wenger back when they were throwing huge amounts of money around, like 2013, 2014. In a sense, it would be a perfect job for him because it's quite a low-pressure job.
Quite romantic.
Very low-pressure job.
Yeah.
I mean, like, probably Monaco have as many fans as could fill the Emirates, like, in entirety. Like, how many Monaco fans are there?
He'll be used to that from last season, though.
They'll finish fourth. He'll get them into top four.
Do you not think Wenger would be more suited to the Michael Emanalo at Monaco role? The technical director?
No,
do you think he still wants to be a manager?
He still sees himself as being a manager, which might be, like... Maybe he shouldn't be, but that is what he wants to do. And I'm sure he will go in. He will continue doing what he wants to do just because he wants to do it.
Would be delightful to see him go to Monaco and then win the league ahead of Tuchel, PSG, Neymar, the whole billion-dollar band. But I guess we'll have to see. Any preferences for Chelsea from you?
I'd like to see Marcelo Bielsa, but it's not going to happen.
No, that would be great.
So I don't know, I guess... It'll probably be somebody boring like Jardim or Unai Emery or you know Enrique or just one of these.
Wenger is actually the correct answer to this question.
Yeah.
Second place, Louis van Gaal. Those would be the two best ones for me. But realistically, I think Jardim. Yeah, I'd say Jardim or Sarri, footballistically.
But Chelsea have shown that you can virtually plug anyone else in there and they're going to do all right. There's not many managers that have been put in there.
They'll do all right, but they won't do as well as they've done on the Conte. You can't replace Conte with anyone half as good.
I think they're on a little bit of a precipice now, and they're in the danger of becoming a team that is fourth to sixth rather than first to third a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you're talking about the tiers a couple of weeks ago.
And also because like their squad's getting older, it's not apparent that they're going to spend the hundreds of millions of pounds they need to refresh it.
Someone told me last week they'll likely have a lower budget than Spurs this summer.
And then they've got...
they missed the Champions League and Hazard might want to try somewhere else.
Yeah, like basically the Chelsea model of relaunching themselves every 2 or 3 years with a new manager. Like, that to do that, you need a lot of really experienced players who can kind of get up every time. But as their squad kind of gets worse, and particularly if they were to lose Hazard or Courtois, then like the benefit of having a relaunch every year or two isn't going to be as effective.
Yeah. Well, I was pleasantly surprised by how frank Hazard was about all this on Tuesday. When, like, you know, it's my last contract. Let's see who we sign. And then his other line is, you know, how do you explain the season? This is Chelsea. When you're your star player, kind of, you're just admitting to the inherent erraticness of your club.
There seems to be a real leadership vacuum as well. I mean, the players that have been there long enough to step up into those kind of roles. I think like Courtois or Willian, they're not, or Kante even, they're not the sort of characters that are gonna take a dressing room and speak for a dressing room.
There is an increasing argument though that those sort of players exist less and less now, and this is the frustration Wenger and Mourinho have had.
Quite millennials,
even beyond millennials, I'd say now.
But like David Luiz was a leader in that squad in that dressing room, and he was completely sidelined by Kante. I think there is a chance for under a new manager if Cahill and David Luiz and co can refine their voice. It doesn't necessarily have to be a dead dressing room. You know, I think it's salvageable is how I describe it. I'm just I'm not sure if they do a full reboot sort of thing, if they bring in a new guy, and like one of those decisions I think that will tell us a lot about which direction they want to go in is whether they just cash in on Ruben Loftus-Cheek or if they try and integrate him.
Yeah.
Because they still haven't integrated anyone from the academy during the Abramovich era, really. And they've got a load of good players there. And a part of the reason that they've never integrated them, I guess, is because they cycle through these managers every 2 or 3 years. And every new manager comes in and wants, oh, I want to bring in Zappa Costa and like, all these rando players that are going to play for 2 years and then get sold on or sent out on loan to Fiorentina, you know, Cuadrado and all the other guys. So,
like, well, if Conte leaves, what are Zappa Costa and Emerson Palmieri there? Like, basically, he's kind of.
They'll go with him as part of his coaching staff.
You know, if Sarri or Jardim come in, they're going to want certain players. That's just how it works. And you do worry for the younger players. I guess Christensen has kind of been integrated now.
But they could have played, like, the team wouldn't have been any worse if they played Aki and Chalobah this year. Obviously, Chalobah was unlucky with that. He got a knee injury after about 3 games to Watford. But he's you know, he's better playing than Bakayoko.
The incredible stuff.
Sold him for 5.5 million. He won player of the month at Bournemouth for seven out of nine.
Heard that on a rival podcast. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
You've been listening to rival podcasts?
I have, actually. Well, you know, you've got to.
The only rival podcast I listen to is Second Captains. But that's not technically rival because it's Irish, maybe?
The UK ones I never listen to.
They're
like a cousin.
You can't get podcasts internationally.
On principle.
Apart from Chelsea, Man United will stick with Mourinho, I guess. But this summer, likely to again be one of those.
Well, does this whole argument about whether Mourinho's third season thing is a myth?
Third season, sorry.
You know,
they did have a third season, correct. Well.
But
racism?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Scatology.
But if you wanted to set up all the circumstances for Mourinho to have a third season meltdown, this will be it. It's all gone.
Only if Conte stayed, maybe. It would be slightly better.
He's not even coming off the back of a title, in the sense that kind of, to a degree, always vindicated his methods and the intensity that kind of burns out players. Whereas now, just that squad. Okay, it's not obviously coming off a major tournament.
Yeah, a lot of players coming off a major tournament. Asking for a lot of players.
There's a lot of...
The start of next season, they're going to have dregs.
Not the scruntlement, but there's disquiet among that United squad. And sort of like... And even the way he's irritated, even in the space of 2 weeks, he's gone from Lukaku being seen as one of his most important players, one of the few players he trusts on, and now he's irritated with Lukaku because he wasn't fit in time. Yeah, exactly. Baye's been frozen out. But it feels like the only player he likes is Matic.
It's classic disruptive leadership.
Yeah. And that doesn't last. And that's why I think that the third season thing isn't a myth at all. I think it's...
So do you think we're going to have a Mourinho season next season? Like a full Mourinho season?
I'm sure I couldn't see anything as bad as Chelsea.
Do you think it'll be more of a Real Madrid third season?
Yeah. I think they could still qualify Champions League, but...
What could it be worse than the Moyes season?
Well, what's the floor for this Man United team? The ceiling is probably second because I think Guardiola's team will be too good again.
The evidence of the Mourinho season is that our idea of a floor is in fact basically Mourinho can plunge through what we think is
but
the
you,
floor.
Do you not think Man United's
team.
Floor is just inherently higher than Chelsea's? Like they've got such a depth of talent.
I think if Pochettino or Conte is in charge of that United squad, they're finishing closer to City and running them.
Yeah, completely.
If one of us was in charge of Manchester United, where would they finish?
Relegation.
You think?
I mean, ultimately they'd go, who is this clown? That would immediately create problems.
Yeah. But I mean, I'd say...
They'd be probably alarmed that a manager with no experience has been put in charge.
Yeah, yeah.
But once they got over that, yeah. I'm probably getting them top five.
Win them round. Yeah. But I think the floor for this United side, unlike that Chelsea side, which was kind of shocking, but I think like a disastrous season for United would probably end up with them finishing fifth or sixth.
It's fifth. The line is that the Champions League line is anything below fourth is a disaster.
Ooh. But the other thing is it wouldn't take a lot for them to drop. You know, it's what, like 6 or 7 points, and they're at the top four.
Would you take away their chips, like Moisey did?
Have they got the chips back though?
I think they have. Yeah,
I'd reinstate the chips.
It's like a Jose move.
I'd reinstate the chips and then take them away.
Really?
Like a few weeks later as a kind of power move.
Would you let them use phones in the dressing room?
Yeah. Well, how else are you going to contact people?
There's some thought you need to be concentrated on the game. Yeah. It's a manager-to-manager thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think if you... Well,
did you see Mick McCarthy's point in his good interview with Ian Ladyman?
I didn't read that.
If you've got McCarthy, and who McCarthy, I suppose, who would be considered old school... He said there's no point taking the phones off young players these days because they've just grown up with them. It's part of themselves. It's their toy. And I suppose the implication was it would be more of a negative effect to take them. It's like, take it away.
I'd be interested to see where Mick lands next as a complete side.
I like Mick.
Probably decent level champo job, I guess. We probably should move on to the Champions League final. Because
a bad season for Mourinho could get worse.
Yes, it could. Because... As well as Guardiola winning, Conte beating him in the cup final, him winning absolutely nothing himself, him falling out of all of his players. If Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool were to beat Real Madrid in the Champions League final, it would be disastrous for Jose Mourinho. But this is not about Jose Mourinho. This is about Liverpool and Real Madrid. So
it's a little bit about Jose Mourinho.
As United fans will tell us after this, yeah.
Everything is about United. Mourinho.
That was a Scouse accent.
So,
not a great day for accents.
Where do you want to start? Where do you even want to start? Liverpool are the outsiders, I think it's fair to say. Real Madrid going for the historic three in a row. You're going to write this week for us what that would mean. You know, the incredible level of dominance that a Real Madrid side have had over the Champions League, despite not actually being dominant in any other sense.
Well, it's three in a row and you get to keep the trophy, kind of making it that gold standard achievement. Or if you win five, and obviously Real have won five in a row, Ajax have won three in a row, Bayern have won three in a row. One of those European Cups, one of those three in a row, they finished, I think it was 11th out of 18 teams in the Bundesliga.
This will be the first three in a row since
76.
76, yeah. So in the modern era of football, it would be quite a feat. And you could say, you know, obviously Liverpool have been quite the force towards the back end of the season, but, you know, they probably will see this as a fairly winnable game where they know they're on top.
Well, it's more than any other final I can remember. It's kind of two teams completely fired by quote-unquote belief, faith, all the rest of it. In Madrid's case, it's outright arrogance, because this is a team, as we've discussed, they never do that well in the league, or they rarely do that well. They've only won one title since 2012. And yet, when they play in Europe, there's just utter assurance. But no matter what's happening, I was at the Juventus game, you were at the Bayern game, Johnny. No matter what's happening, they just kind of have this inherent trust, we're going to get through because we're Real Madrid. And it kind of radiates around the ground. And then on the other side, you've got Liverpool, who also have, in a different way, they know they're not as good as Real, but
incredible belief there.
Yeah.
Can I just say, there's nothing personal, nothing against the pod. I find nothing more soul-numbingly boring than talking about Real Madrid and all their wins and like all the things they could win. Aren't they great, Real Madrid?
They're not great though.
Yeah, exactly. This final is, for me, it's all about Liverpool, and it's all about what they've done to get there. It's about a team from what you talked about last week. There's maybe six or seven teams in the elite, and basically we've assumed that the Champions League will rotate amongst those teams. Liverpool are not in that. They're not in that group. Nobody at the start of the season would have given them even the slightest possibility of getting to this. And they've played some great football along the way, and they have the capacity to do something spectacular, which is blow the best teams in Europe off the pitch. And I think. That's why this final kind of excites people in a way that Real Atletico or Real Bayern just wouldn't.
Do you think all true lovers of football should want Liverpool win?
Well, it's easy to be cynical about this kind of stuff, and you know, but there's thousands of them going out there without, they don't, you know, sleeping on people's floors. I mean, I'm really sleeping.
You're
on
not
somebody's
far off. Yeah.
I'm sleeping on somebody's floor. You know, Si Hughes is going to be sleeping on somebody's sofa.
And he's in a hostel.
He's in a
hostel.
Accommodation was that difficult to get at this late stage?
He's in a hostel. I'm sleeping on a floor. Sort that out.
The logistics side of this has been unbelievably difficult.
Yeah.
More difficult than Russia, which has been
a
pain in the ass as well.
Do you think that it's been so bad that UEFA should not give finals to places like Kiev in future?
Well,
fortunately, they're not going to already.
Yeah. So these are part of basically a less stringent level of requirements under the old Michel Platini selection method. Yeah. So that's changing for next season. I remember talking to someone who went in UEFA after Cardiff last year, and he said, yeah, it's something that once this kind of process passes, we'll be looking. Because I think a huge part of it, basically Champions League is a kind of, I don't want to use a term like this, but it's a global mega event, probably the second biggest fixture in sport. And so it's got to the point now where
one of the biggest one-off events.
A city should have the infrastructure, both in terms of travel and accommodation,
even if that inevitably means that it will only, you know, you would be limiting it to London, Paris, Berlin.
But
there are a lot of cities that can do it. I think there are a lot of cities.
But there's I don't know, 10 max, 8.
Well, let's put to flip that question on its head. It is logical though that only a city that's big enough to host it should host it. It's not about not bringing it to red. It's just about the basic logistics.
Well, let's count them up. London could.
Yeah. London absolutely could.
Manchester
definitely could.
Manchester couldn't.
The only thing about Manchester, I suppose, is the urban area around it could weather it, maybe.
There's loads of hotels in central Manchester and also in the Salford area, I think.
Because they're in Liverpool as well.
Even around Manchester Airport, like there's, I think Manchester would be fine. I think Liverpool couldn't.
Manchester, no, Liverpool definitely kind of struggled when with the Super League Grand Final night.
Did it?
Yeah.
I mean, I was there for the UEFA Cup final when Rangers lost to Zenit. I mean, that was chaos, but a lot of the people weren't staying, I guess.
Oh, Manchester, maybe.
I think I'd agree. I think I'd go lean inside that Manchester no longer.
Rome?
Yes.
Milan?
Milan, it was tricky to get accommodation in 2016, but just about enough.
I mean, it was but the thing is, it's one of those where it's like, if you book after the semi-finals, it's difficult in every single city, except probably London, Paris, Madrid. Berlin,
Madrid, Barcelona, Munich.
No, Munich was difficult.
Oh, so. Munich difficult.
Yeah.
Moscow could, I guess.
Yeah, Moscow definitely could.
Moscow definitely could.
Big tourist cities, Athens, Prague.
Prague hasn't got a big enough stadium, I think.
Yeah.
Warsaw, I think could
Vienna
just about.
Could.
Zurich, Vienna.
No, Jurgen Klopp's stadium either.
Is it not big enough?
No, he's got the...
Basel's not big enough?
No. Basel really struggled with Europa League with Liverpool.
Stockholm?
Marseille?
I don't know Stockholm well enough.
The south of France has got significant accommodation.
I found it difficult for the semi-final of the Euros.
It's one of the things with Kiev, it's the same... and it's funny because British people are naturally defensive of Cardiff and they say, well, no, you can stay in Bristol or London. There are trains. So, yeah, I'm sure for the Kiev final, we could stay in some sort of 50-mile-away town that I've never heard of.
But it doesn't have that surrounding. It's more isolated than...
But the thing with Cardiff was, the city was completely, like, bursting. It was just overflowing with people. There was just too many people in a small space. And one of the great strengths of Cardiff is that what was the Millennium Stadium is in the middle. But the city felt too small to be hosting an event of that size. Where we had Real Madrid and Juve fans coming in from different countries and they were spilling over, you know, a lot of them just slept on the street. I saw people sleep in the train station.
There's
Dublin could, couldn't it?
No, it'd be too small.
Is it?
Yeah, if you say so.
They host a big rugby games and stuff, right?
Yeah, but come on, like rugby doesn't happen.
They'll go home afterwards.
Well, whatever about kind of the debate about rugby football, but we're talking about a global mega event. So I don't think Dublin could. Mm. But like you see the story yesterday, 2000... Real Madrid tickets have been sent back because of all of them citing logistics, which is scandalous.
When do we think the first Champions League final outside of Europe will happen?
It's not far off, is it?
Presumably, there's no.
It shouldn't happen,
but it will, right? Like it'll happen in. It'll be in
what's
Hong
the first
Kong,
one? Do you reckon the first
New
one?
York.
Do you reckon the first one will be Asia or New York? I would say New York.
First one will be London.
Oh, very good. Mm. No, I mean, I could see. And like you know, it's going to happen with everything. So like they will one day probably do a Super Bowl in London once they've worked out the timings.
Yeah.
And they will one day do a Champions League final in
Asia,
Qatar, or Beijing, or
Korea.
It could be anywhere.
I think it could go to Baku under existing. You know, it wouldn't have to.
It could be in Baku. Yeah.
And presumably, like
the Europa League. Final
a topic
in Baku,
we talked a lot about recently is like a new Super League. Or a new European Super League, which Wenger spoke about in a press conference the other week. And, you know, there's been a lot of reporting recently about this. Presumably, these new tournaments would, like, be played wherever they can
make
the most
money. Sounds like they're not going to go through. FIFA were trying to call an extraordinary meeting.
The 2014, like, World Club Championship.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
did you read Tariq Panja's piece in the New York Times about the growing influence of Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, well, I've got to say, Tariq's reporting on this, the New York Times has been absolutely top draw. Fundamentally, the interesting things are, this is Infantino's last year of his reign.
Yeah.
He needs to get re-elected. To get re-elected, basically, you promise people money. And you have to get money from somewhere.
Mm.
And he's looking around at all these different ideas. And this consortium of Saudi money, funded by the Japanese bank SoftBank, came to FIFA and said, well, we will buy the Club World Cup off you and the Confederations Cup, basically, and reorganize them. And the Confederations Cup will become... like a global nations league sort of thing. And the Club World Cup will happen when the Confederations Cup used to happen, once every 4 years, 24-team club tournament. Now, why is this important? Because club football is overtaking international football.
Yeah.
Clubs make crap loads of money. So you could make... FIFA would finally be getting a bit of that club pie.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd be getting a bit of that cash for a massive...
Bean.
Can you imagine that tournament?
He's Bunce, tidy earner.
It's a Bunce burner. And you're looking at that, and it's like Infantino is going to have... like an idea. He's got to have an idea to get this money. This won't go through because apparently there's too much opposition to it. So now he's scrambling to try and find something.
What was even interesting in that reading Tariq's piece, first of all, the Saudis are basically one of the main investors in this global club idea. Yet at the same time, so they're trying to do business with FIFA. Yet at the same time, FIFA, or well, more, I suppose more so at the AFC under FIFA, the Saudis have tried to set up this kind of this regional power block, and FIFA, may have to, FIFA basically have to crack down on that. It's against the way they organise themselves. So there's already, and at the very start of this kind of Saudi influence, there's these big conflicts.
And I think we're also going to see, everyone's kind of, it's flying under the radar because the World Cup starts on the Thursday, but on the Wednesday, the day before, we're going to have the decision over 2026.
That was something else interesting about the piece, because I suppose we've been not worried, but I suppose for so long thinking Morocco could do this, whereas now if the Saudis suddenly, as was the implication in Tariq's piece, instruct 10 to 15 federations to vote for the states, then
FIFA are trying everything they can to prevent Morocco, aren't they?
There was talk about them being disbarred from even the vote.
Yeah, they tried to, even at the start of the process, FIFA were trying to engineer the process in such a way that it wouldn't really be a proper contest. They kind of wanted to skip the contest part of it. And so it
but let's remember, Morocco have got a history. I mean, not that other countries are innocent in this, but Morocco have got a history of paying bribes to get votes for World Cup bids.
Yeah,
They supposedly, according to one FIFA exec, whose name I can't remember, but I wrote about it, they won the vote for 2010 over South Africa, and Blatter just saw it and was like, no, South Africa's having this one, and just gave it to South.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Africa. So that whole thing is going to be pretty messy. And the difference is huge for Infantino again, because the US bid is promising record revenues, which again is all most FIFA people care about, whereas the Morocco bid is a developmental idea.
Although actually, while the US bid has on its side this argument made by, I think, Fox, that they would basically give FIFA a lot more money if it went to the US, Morocco's bid is also to do with TV. Like, they say that, well, because they're basically on GFC, British summertime, therefore they, like, it's the most, it would be the most convenient for TV in Europe, Middle East and Asia. In a way
1 p.m. kickoffs in Africa in the summer, though.
Yeah, but who cares? Who cares about the players? Whereas, like, if we're having games in Portland and Vancouver, that would obviously be really bad for TV in Hong Kong. And that is literally the Moroccan argument.
Yeah.
Obviously, the players would much rather it be in the US. But even again with the Morocco, like, I've got quite a lot of, I think Morocco is an interesting idea for World Cup. But even then, you hear these complaints coming from that side saying, Donald Trump's tweeting about it, there has to be political interference. Like, literally the king of Morocco is behind the Moroccan bid and running the whole Moroccan bid.
Just remember how the English bid for 2006 went.
Prince William, David Cameron.
Miguel and I were talking about this the other day. The idea of the three lions, Beckham, Cameron, and Prince William.
We literally set the future king as well as Cameron and Prince William.
Going around glad handing, saying to people, I'm sure they would have said, the city of Manchester Stadium looks fantastic. Yeah. And we've you can get to Manchester Piccadilly in 2 hours and 7 minutes.
Would you like the Falklands back, Mr. Grondona?
Nicolas Layoz said he wanted a knighthood. He wanted a knighthood and the FA Cup named after him.
I find it remarkable that kind of glad handing didn't win against the force of the nature of the Russian and Qatari bids.
Yeah. two votes. One of them being Jeff Thompson's, presumably.
Hard to know as well what happened with the Russian bid, because they just, the computer, they didn't need the computer, so they just destroyed him.
We can probably sort you tickets for Glyndebourne Festival, or maybe a box at Lords. And
All points east.
I don't know if you've ever met James Corden, but he'd be very happy to come and meet you. He's a really fantastic chap.
Yeah.
And
funny.
I got Anton Deck, who you could meet, and
Susan Boyle,
the Arctic Monkey.
Yeah, Arctic Monkey.
Who was big in 2010?
Susan Boyle,
Arctic Monkey.
And then from the much.
What's that name of that One Direction? Yeah, there we go.
From the much.
You've had lunch with Damon Albarn.
The much hated tyrannical money-obsessed giant against the developmental prospect. We returned to Liverpool against Real Madrid, which we were talking about half an hour ago. and Johnny has certainly nailed his colours to the mast, and they are red on this. This is a Liverpool final, not a Real Madrid one. But Real Madrid are... You know, could you say that this is the last final of their big era? Because can you imagine Ronaldo doing one more year of high-level performance? I
mean, every year we kind of say, like, it gets November. Nah, he's done now. Look at him. He's flailing. And then February they're playing Paris Saint-Germain or Bayern or someone. Yeah, Ronaldo, 70th minute.
But this goal. Is all,
this is all just, done it again.
This is just a prelude to them trying to sign Neymar or something, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like, if they do get Neymar this summer, if they get the big... I know it's difficult.
It's been suggested to me by people who know around the Neymar circle that it's now looking unlikely to happen this summer. And in January they were saying it's going to happen, but now I think the logistics are too difficult.
He's going to have a fun time next season when Thomas Tuchel shows up with a massive manual about counter-pressing positions.
Yeah.
And Neymar, here's your put this DVD into your laptop, and it contains all the different scenarios for different phases of play with and without the ball in certain sectors of the pitch, which you need to do so you can take the correct counter-pressing positions depending on which formation we're using at the time. And they'd be like, you what?
Yeah. He'll throw it in the pool with all the strippers.
Yeah. I'm going to go and try on a massive coat made of gold.
Did you read that incredible, was it Diego Torres, that piece of,
where
Unai Emery turned up at Neymar's house? Because there's party ongoing. He's like, well, I left at 10 p.m. so Neymar didn't turn up for training for like 3 days. The guy's having the best time of his life.
It is amazing.
Why the hell would you sign for Real Madrid when you just do what you want? You just got like...
But there is this danger of him getting bored as well. Like, this seems to be... Ken made the point in one of the podcasts at our friends, Second Captains, that the only thing that seems to motivate Neymar is boredom. Like, it does feel like he's got his entourage around him to sort of control his life. But and the only time he actually takes control... when he asserts himself, basically, can't be bothered with this. Because I heard a story about him at some shoot, and he was about, like, he was meant to take a certain amount of time, and I got a lot of it done, and there had to be some slight delay or something like that, and then but they still had a bit to do, and Neymar just, I'm off.
That'll do.
You've got enough there.
But it is funny, is it? Because Neymar, he's one of the most talented footballers I've ever seen, I think, actually, in terms of pure talent, he is incredible. But I was talking to a Brazilian friend about this, and he was saying, as soon as you give these Brazilians a load of money, like, they all turn like this. You know, if you, like, throughout history, look at Ronaldinho, as soon as you gave him all the cash and gave him the freedom to go and party.
To be fair.
Very religious, wasn't he? But, like, there's such a history of like Adriano and the guys who just go off the rails and they go party and then they can't deal with the fun.
I have to say, like, it's obviously hilarious. Like, obviously, he's such a ridiculous person that this whole thing is hilarious. So everything he does is funny. But I do feel slightly let down. Like, I thought he was cool.
Yeah,
like, in the 2014 World Cup, I thought he was really cool. And he scored that pen against Chile, in the shootout.
Yeah.
And he was, like, the only good thing about that awfully dysfunctional Brazil
and
team.
The amount of pressure.
And
then he went to Barcelona,
job.
And he was brilliant. Like, he absolutely killed it at Barcelona and was part of the best front three in history and didn't even play for himself. He was playing for his teammates and was reveling in playing with Suarez and Messi and being in the best team of all time. And now he's just a complete twat.
That was the other thing, actually, about that interview that came out recently, where it seemed like, because there's been this undercurrent that Neymar was jealous of Messi and he wanted to be his own player. But it seems, no, that's what his entourage wants, whereas he actually enjoyed just kind of taking the piss with Neymar or with Messi and Suarez.
Yeah, I feel like his entourage does have too much sway. Mm.
The way I see Neymar is he's kind of football's Justin Bieber.
Are they mates?
Too much, too young.
Since the age of 13 or 14, people have danced to his tune in a way that I guess Ronaldo probably wouldn't. You know, you wouldn't say that about Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Or Messi even. He's basically been ordering people around ever since his teenage years, and also dealing with all the blowback that comes from being that huge in a country that into football. And so I think we can't measure him by how we measure ordinary people, you know.
Right, that's fair enough. Yeah,
he's got to a stage in life where he literally just wants to have as much fun as possible and explore, you know, the very outer boundaries of what he can do with his fame and his money.
Yeah.
And you know, if Bieber occasionally puts out a couple of good tunes a year, if he plays, you know, some good football in the meantime by accident, then you know, we'll just have to be grateful for that.
For Neymar, is it too late now to say sorry? I think it's a, as ever, a very sage point that you make. I think the weird thing with Neymar is that these Brazilian players become like a business around which an entire community sort of forms, in a way that has never happened with Messi. Like even now, Messi's entourage is tiny. Yeah. It's his dad and his wife, I guess. And even so, she's very like out of the business stuff.
And Sam Borden from the New York Times.
ESPN. I actually thought that was an interesting piece because, you know, there's nothing left to be written about Messi because he doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm going to write about how he doesn't say anything.
I haven't read the piece yet, but have you seen the stuff from Argentina in which Messi, all these reports about Messi's discussions with Sampaoli about where he should play in the team? And it's not an ego thing. It's basically Messi has figured out that if he plays here, there's space on this side of the pitch. It's actually really interesting, like the level of tactical.
Messi now, he's not about him. Like he wants to win the World Cup for Argentina. But you could say that is for him. But the whole point is he is willing to sacrifice himself to put that team in the best chance of winning. Because I think he felt before that his role in that Sabella team was they were giving him the ball and then it was up to him to win it. Whereas actually, that's not the best use of a good player.
Yeah.
Is, yeah, put me in a great, important role, fine. But like, let's have someone there and let's have someone there. I think, you know, a big problem for them is that Dybala and him couldn't play together. Yeah. And they really want to try and get them in the same team if they can.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Like, I think Messi's going to have a great game in the Champions League final. Oh, no, hang on, are we still talking about that?
Can I just say, like, this is how determined we are to avoid talking about Real Madrid. That we literally talk about, you know, glide.
I know, we're going to have to give it. I get so much abuse from the Liverpool fans when we don't give them enough airtime. So, from 1 to 11, Liverpool will start and go with Karius. You're going to write about Karius this week.
Hopefully, yeah.
What your feelings on...
Are we going to run through the whole Liverpool team?
We're going to just have a couple of lines on each player.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Pen picks.
It's just an idea I thought up now, so we might as well do it. Karius,
most average goalkeeper ever to start a Champions League final.
That's a good start. Right back, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Jack.
Told by Jurgen Klopp that he was in the England squad because Southgate wanted to let Klopp break the good news.
Beautiful.
It's actually an interesting...
Why was that? It's
a nice dynamic,
right? I think Southgate was like... Southgate said managers have to have so many bad conversations with players, like you're dropped, you're sold, whatever, that he wanted to let Klopp have this good one.
That's quite good.
There is an interesting argument.
Slowly like, falling in love with
I think Alexander-Arnold could start... I mean, I don't want to turn this into an England podcast, but could start for England ahead of Trippier. Because it's going to be one of the two of them. And as Southgate said, like he wouldn't have taken Alexander-Arnold unless he was confident in picking him. And you could argue that Alexander-Arnold's probably had a better season than Trippier.
Yeah, yeah.
If he has a really good Champions League final... I mean, it'll be a huge thing.
And he's got
him.
No caps. Not many England players would have started the first game of a World Cup with no caps.
Hmm. Had Martin Kelly played when he went to the Euros?
Euro 2012.
Did Flanagan went to
2014? Was it? He had a great
Flanagan
season.
Flanagan went
2014. Flanny Alves.
Centre backs. So Virgil van Dijk, Miguel.
Has.
You get what you pay for.
Yeah. I mean, there is an argument that. That was one of the most...
Not with peanut butter. The more you pay on peanut butter, the worse it is.
That's bollocks.
The best peanut butter is the supermarket stuff.
No, because it's got palm oil in.
Okay, well...
I have no palm oil in my peanut butter.
Oh, yeah, but I've got this really ethical Biona stuff.
Jesus.
It's like $4.99.
You've got to stir it.
There's nothing to stir anymore. It's basically like cement. It's like hardened cement.
So you're
more of a sun tap man.
No, I'm has basically given Skippy.
Do you not think it's a very Real Madrid thing to do? Go and spend 70 million on a centre back.
Is it?
Well, they spent 30 million on Sergio Ramos about 10 years ago, which is a completely different era when it was mad. He was like 19.
He was a right back at the time as well, Sergio.
Well, I mean, it's one of those purchases that turns out to be a bit like United spending all that money on Rooney when he was a teenager.
Or Ferdinand.
It works out.
Actually, do you like Sergio Ramos?
I love him.
Yes, I do.
Absolutely love him. I think he's like he's a hero to so many footballers and kids who play football because he's kind of made defending cool and not just like, you know, bring it out from the back, but he's made like the actual like the physicality of defending cool and sexy. Like if you talk to any young defender now at any level of the game, like I was speaking to Ben Wilmot at Stevenage about this, who's one of the best young defenders in the country, and he's telling me how much he loves Ramos. I know even like non-league footballers of whom I follow a lot on Twitter, they're always tweeting about Ramos, like, oh, I love how he protects his players, I love how he represents his team. I think he's I love watching him.
Yeah.
I love his Instagram, which is a phenomenon. Like, he did this post the other day where he had like a picture of Buffon, Torres and Iniesta. So, the three of them next to each other. So thank you so much for enlarging and strengthening the game or something over your careers. He's been an honour to play with and against you guys. He did a post the other day when he'd met David Beckham at some event and the two of them hugging, and he said something like, met the man with the most tattoos per centimetre of his skin and the man with the most love in the world. And like within about 5 minutes, I had 1.3 million likes.
Is that your ambition?
Kind of swiftly realised I'm never going to get 1.3 million likes for all of my Instagram posts put together. But he's, he's such an interesting, engaging guy. Like, I think I like, I know he plays for Real Madrid and stuff, but I want him to do well. And I've got immense
respect for him, because he's a very good defender, but he's actually got a lot of flaws.
Yeah.
But he covers them incredibly well, which is half the battle, really, in being a player, isn't it?
Another thing about him, where I kind of thought really changed my mind about him, and it's quite a simple thing maybe, but 2012, absolutely skied the penalty that got Madrid knocked out of the Champions League when they hadn't won one for ages. Then in that Euros, takes one of the decisive penalties against Portugal, tries the same thing, chips it into the corner.
Mentality obviously is a key part of an elite footballer.
Yeah.
And he is always the player, like, in Spanish their term is like to give face. Like, basically it's fronting up after a bad result, and it's always him. Absolutely always him. He's also the most Spanish bloke of all times. He said, if you weren't a footballer, what would you be? And he said, I'd probably be a bullfighter.
If he hadn't have smashed in that header in the last minute of 2014 final, we'd be having a very different conversation today. That launched this great era of Real Madrid, like, brilliance and also kind of supreme self-confidence in all situations.
Yeah.
And were it not for that, I mean, God knows who would have won the last two Champions Leagues, Bayern, City, whoever. So he's like a big figure in the history of the game.
There's that great footage from after the second leg of the semi-final where he basically goes in amongst the Madrid fans and starts, you know, I think somebody hands him a beer or something, and then he's getting involved in all the chants, which Miguel could probably.
Do you remember that clip from when I think Real Madrid beat Sevilla in a big game like a year or two ago when Sampaoli was manager of Sevilla. And Ramos goes up to Sampaoli afterwards and gives him a big hug. And, you know, because it's on Spanish TV, they've, like, guessed what they were saying. And he was saying something like, it was something incredibly Sergio Ramos, like, football belongs to you. Football belongs to the men with the big balls.
Yeah. But I do like the way, and Ramos is clearly someone as well who is very invested in both football as a sport and the identity of his club. It's not just a job to him in that way.
Yeah, completely. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's so appealing to people who, you know, are not Spanish or Real Madrid fans.
Yes,
yeah.
These really strong strands are basically that Castilian Spanish strand. The masculinity, he's incredibly, like, everything about him is all about being that hyper masculine bloke, which is a kind of part of Spanish society as well.
I was thinking about this earlier, about comparing him and John Terry, because obviously John Terry represents a strand of, like, English hyper masculinity and English, like, pride in being English and also pride in his club. Is Ramos, like, simply a Spanish equivalent of the same?
To me, Terry's seems much more performative. I think it comes more naturally to Sergio Ramos.
I think there's an element of performance to Ramos as well, but I think it's a good analogy. But I think Sergio Ramos was I think Terry made a lot more out of limited ability than Ramos, who's a genuinely talented footballer. I say he does have flaws, but Sergio Ramos has been a great defender for like 10 years, and he's got
in two different positions as well. Like, in when Spain won the World Cup in 2010, he was a right back. And then the next tournament, he forms a partnership with Piqué.
And as a bloke, I would say, you know, Ramos is streets ahead.
Yeah.
By the looks of it.
We'll just carry on whipping through that Liverpool team. who's going to start at the centre-back? Lovren. Lovren, did you read about him with that trial in Croatia? You know, the head of the Croatian FA, that guy's going to... Someone left a piece of paper on the side, and it was what Lovren had been instructed to testify. So he's got some interesting off-field stuff going on. Will he be able to cope with the Real Madrid front line?
Well, Van Dijk beside him, it's looked like he's been
better. But I've never seen a really high-level defender let the ball go over his head as much as Lovren.
Yeah,
Liverpool have been really solid since around the turn of the year. But, you know, since Van Dijk has come in, and so all this kind of, you know, this remnants of people saying, well, they're still slightly shaky at the back, which we did see during the Roma game. It's not actually been the story of Liverpool's second half of the season, really.
It's more been just their lethal attack, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and that's where all the attention goes.
Jordan Henderson?
Robertson. Andy Robertson.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I've got left back. Andy Robertson.
Hero. One of the
hero.
Yeah. Heartwarming stories of the campaign.
Well, he was at, what, Queen's Park, was it? Five years ago?
Queen's Park.
It's quite a rise. And he's been kind of one of the real successes. You need to have the low price guys that really explode, as well as paying the big money for players. And they've paid, what, 8 million for him, and he's turned out to be an outstanding left back. Jordan Henderson?
He's turned into into the real leader of the team in a way, which I didn't expect. He did a fantastic interview with Ollie Holt in the Mail on Sunday the other day, talking about leadership. I think so much so that I'm not going to make this into England again.
Does he start for England for you?
I think he kind of has to. I think even if it's down to him or Eric Dier, you'd choose Henderson.
He's going to be skipper, isn't he, probably, I think.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I think he'll start as captain, even if it means benching Dier.
And who will start alongside Henderson in midfield for Liverpool?
Milner and Wijnaldum, I guess, because Chan seems to be frozen out, right?
Or he's leaving.
Going to Juventus.
Lallana is...
Genie Wijnaldum. It's a good chance.
Is he injured still? No, Lallana's all right.
Lallana's going to be on the bench, I'd expect.
Probably surely not fit enough.
So Milner plays a crucial role in that team because he's just so versatile. He just kind of fills every hole.
Little soldier legs. So that's a Barney Rone line. Little soldier legs.
Ginny Wijnaldum has been surprisingly good. I mean, he was good at Newcastle, we thought, but then he's actually kind of kicked on.
It's incredible what Liverpool have done with these kind of off cuts of elite. So Ginny Wijnaldum was getting relegated with Newcastle.
15 mil, was it?
Yeah.
Like, you should do a piece on this, actually. It's true, but what Liverpool has actually done...
Robertson got relegated
with Hull City.
This is underrated, actually. Klopp's job has actually been magnificent here.
Lovren was like fine at Saints in mid-table.
Nobody thought Mane was going to be like this good. Everybody thought, you know, he's a decent player, but
it felt like a little bit of an overpay, I thought, at the time.
And when they got Firmino,
well, someone at Hoffenheim told me that was an overpay. You know, that they said he's never going to be a top striker. Well,
it was like, I remember there was lots of criticism of the transfer committee Edwards and how Liverpool were doing. And part of the argument was like, they spent 30 million on Roberto Firmino.
I was at the Copa America when they signed them, and he was playing for Brazil. And like, it was hard, like, you're kind of watching it. It was a dreadful Brazil team who did awfully. And so that's probably some of the context. But you're kind of looking at Firmino and saying, where does this guy play? He's okay, like, but...
Who should start for Brazil? Firmino or Gabriel Jesus?
I'm biased, so I recuse myself from this conversation.
I'd still start Johnny? Jesus.
What about Neymar?
Neymar's probably going to play number 10, I think.
Well, then you'd probably go Jesus. Because I think Firmino's role at Liverpool is... And the reason why people didn't really see where he'd fit in is that he had this very strange role there, which is almost kind of unique to them.
He's a 9.5.
He's a 9.5, yeah. Mm. He's like a...
There are managers who wouldn't be able to use him. You could pretty much pick him out.
Rodgers probably couldn't. Actually, I would have thought he should have been a Rodgers player because he's kind of... Play between the lines, all of that.
A what?
I thought he was
Brendan.
Oh, Roger, yeah.
Who else have we missed? Oh, Mohamed Salah, apparently he's quite good.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting I think we might have touched on this before, but in the comparison with Neymar, is that when Neymar joined PSG, his kind of dream vision for the season would be scoring like shed loads of goals, breaking an individual goal scoring record for the league. It's through his own brilliance, guiding his team to the Champions League final. And yet, Salah has basically had the season that Neymar would have hoped for. Yeah. Salah has proven that he's kind of got humility is probably the best word for it. He's got the humility to make the most of his talents for like a functional team and therefore has actually the best chance of making history this year.
And as Ed pointed out off air before the podcast, that could really be the tactical key to this final. Salah.
I think we're going to have to do that piece. I mean, someone's going to have to watch those games because... It was Zidane as well. It's Zidane's Real Madrid, and he destroyed them for
against
Roma.
But he missed all. This shows his rise.
He missed or fluffed so many opportunities, like put the pass in the wrong place or put the shot wide or whatever, or a good save by Keylor Navas. But that gap between Marcelo and Sergio Ramos, he diced it all day long in both legs.
Shall I do that? Shall I bin off carrier? Shall I do that?
I think it's more interesting.
I think it'd be a really interesting piece. You should watch both legs. Just watch both legs of that quarterfinal. I think it's quarterfinal. And yeah, I think, and that's why I do think Liverpool could win, because Real Madrid almost are going to have to try and play a deeper line to counteract them.
I think this is like the big question, is that
how do you defend against Salah? Is it,
like, there's a way to frustrate Liverpool and there's a way to play into their hands. And does Real Madrid's arrogance mean that they will play into Liverpool's hands? Like, are they smart enough to deny themselves that kind of expansive performance and actually do the clever thing?
Well, this comes down to basically this idea we talked about of belief, arrogance. But Real Madrid are either confident enough or arrogant enough, if you like, to think if it comes to a shootout, we'll win.
Mm. What I would do if I was Real Madrid, this is not what Zidane would do, but what I would do is I would play deeper, because I think Liverpool's biggest threat, as we've seen in these big games, is that counter. Mm. I'd play deeper, so there's not much space behind Ramos and Marcelo, and you know, Varane is one of the quickest covering defenders in the world, but I don't want to leave much space. And then play Ronaldo as a centre-forward, and then Bale and Asensio on either side, and you counter them, because they won't be able to deal with that sort of speed. You know, when Bale gets going, when Asensio gets going, I think you let Liverpool come forward and spring them. It won't be what Klopp's expecting.
So which midfielder would you drop?
I would play Casemiro, Modric and Isco.
Kroos?
In there.
No, Kroos.
Oh, sorry. God, Kroos. Yeah, Isco's got to go. Yeah, fine.
Madrid, this season, Madrid have come closer to getting done than ever before. Like, in the sense that they were on the brink against Juve, on the brink against Bayern. Can Liverpool actually push them over the edge?
We're 3-0 down to Wolfsburg after the first leg, you know, like a couple of seasons ago. Like, we've had this.
Was it 2-0, though? No? I kind of been 3-0.
I think it was.
They won. I think it was. No, it was 3-1, and then they won 3-0. Yeah. Ronaldo scored the hat trick. But, you know, they always go to the brink and come back. But it's possibly that they need to. I don't know. They don't need to change things up. They, you know, they always win. But I would be interested to see how they do it.
Got to take a note of all this from a preview.
We probably need to wrap things up soon, because we've been here for about 2 hours.
Oh, Jesus. I think, I'm not going to make it.
Where are you?
I'm not going to make it to Lords.
No, you can. Was it to 12:30?
No, it's 12.
Okay.
Oh, no. It's listeners, it's currently 11:49.
Yeah, it's currently 11:49, and I need to be at Lords at the ECB offices for 12, which is not going to happen.
But we will say,
Go.
Should we do a prediction for each? You want to predict it?
I think whoever scores first will lose.
Lose?
Yeah.
Okay, I like that. Jacko?
I'm going to go for Liverpool. I've been convinced.
I think so as well. Again, in spite of myself. And
I'm going to say 4-2 to Liverpool.
If that's the case, it will be the first time both clubs in a Champions League final have scored more than one goal since.
I think this is going to be.
Hang on. 2011, 2010, Istanbul.
Yeah.
While Johnny's thinking, or just got it right, I think the fact that it's an attack, like, should be an attacking final, is basically why lots of people will care a lot more about this final. I think it's going to be really interesting from that point of view. Obviously, two clubs that would consider themselves European royalty as well. So we look forward to that. And I guess we'll be around next Tuesday after the bank holiday to discuss that with the returning Ukrainians to my left and right. And also Jack, who's going to be at the Championship playoff final.
Oh, yes.
So we will have either Fulham or Aston Villa as a Premier League team next time we speak. But until that point, all I have to do is thank Johnny for your time today.
You're welcome.
Miguel.
Thank you.
Jacko, thank you.
My pleasure.
And all the listeners, as ever, if you've made it this far, then we really value you. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.